first reaction to perpetrators of rape and child molestation is to lock them up and throw away the key. Yet many argue that sex offenders are often victims of abuse themselves and need treatment. Treatment programs have been designed to reduce the risk of reoffending, but does treatment work well enough to keep communities safe? What if a sex offender can't be rehabilitated? Should we just keep them in treatment forever, even after their jail term has expired? This is Central Standard, and I'm Susan Wilson. Today, we're talking about sex offender programs and whether they can actually cure sex offenders. Later in the hour, we'll sit down with a crime novelist to talk about a life of crime. Crime writing, that is. But first we look at the sometimes complicated world of sex offender justice. Joining us today is Dr. Austin Delaurier, a clinical and counseling psychologist with the Larned State Hospital. Welcome to Central Standard, Dr. Delaurier.
Thank you, Dr. Wilson.
So I guess my first question is, what goes into rehabilitating sex offenders, and why is rehabilitating them so difficult?
Well, actually, treatment of sex offenders may not be as difficult as many people think. I mean, the success rates with well-designed treatment programs have recidivism rates of about 3 to 8%, which is quite low and lower than we would experience, for example, if we were working with depressed folks or addicted people or some of the other problems that psychology deals with. I think the issue we face, at, particularly at our program, which is designed to receive, you know, some of the worst offenders, is that society wants a zero rate. I mean, they, and understandably so, want no more victims, and that's a very difficult standard to get there. In fact, you can't guarantee that. You can only approach it as closely as possible.
So, speaking of your program, when did the program get started, and I understand there were some high visibility cases at that time that triggered the creation of the program.
That's right. It began in 1994. The event in Kansas that triggered that was the rape and murder of a Pittsburgh State student, Stephanie Schmidt, and my understanding is that her family had some connections with legislators, but to help motivate them as well. But that the public was enraged because Donald Gideon, the perpetrator, had been released months before on parole, and apparently had given indications that he didn't feel fully in control of his urges. And in any event, she disappeared from a bar one night where they both worked. She was celebrating her 21st birthday, to my understanding, and approximately 30 days later, he turned himself in. The outrage from the public was huge, and the result was the passing of this sexual predator treatment law, and shortly after that, the first resident of the program, a man named Leroy Hendricks, was admitted, and he promptly sued the program. And
what was the basis of his lawsuit?
He was saying that constitutionally that he had served his time, and that the state had no right to, in effect, incarcerate him again. And our program was generally modeled after a couple of other programs around the country, but our case was the first one to make it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court found that there was a state interest in generation of people
So you said that your program was modeled around another program in the country. So walk me through what a sex offender treatment program looks like day by day. I mean, do they do groups? Do they do individual counseling? How does that work? Because it is a residential program. In other words, they stay there for the duration of their treatment, right?
That's correct, yes. Well, the year is divided into to four quarters in most parts of the program, and 12-week quarters with a week of alternative activities in between. And there's an enrollment period for each quarter, and each resident is expected to enroll for at least 20 hours of treatment-related work.
So describe some of the treatment-related work they would do. Are they groups on impulse control, or what exactly goes into treating a sex offender specifically?
Well, a lot of the many of the, there's typically in the day starts with some group work by the residents. These many of the groups are what we call phase groups, which depend on what there are seven phases of advancement in the program, and it depends what phase the resident is in, but that group will focus on the tasks of that phase. For example, discussing in one of the tasks might be discussing in detail each victim that the person had according to a form that we have for reviewing that, asking how the person, deceived the victim, how what effects that may have had on their victim, things like that, guided list of questions.
Well, let me ask you this. There are, and you said at the beginning that these sex offender programs, when you compare them to other conditions, have a comparable treatment success rate. But there are, you're probably aware, there are psychologists who say you can't cure someone from being a sexual predator, so to speak, that that treatment really doesn't work for all people. So how do you respond to that? And what kinds of sex offenders tend to do well in treatment as opposed to those that don't?
Well, I would respond to it first by saying that there's a good deal of misinformation about sex offenders and an exaggerated fear in the public. I believe these folks tend to be seen as sort of drooling monsters in alleyways, ready to jump on anyone who comes by or something. When really most are fairly inadequate people who function by one being camouflaged by the social system, so they're they're the choir master or the Boy Scout leader, somebody you don't think of, and two, they tend to take a relationship and manipulate it and twist it, and so once they're identified in the public, they really have a whole lot less power, but the public doesn't see that as well yet. The other thing is there's some confusion, I think, with the fact that we can't, once a person has committed a sex offense, we will never be able to say they never will again, because it's now part of their behavioral repertoire. I mean, it's something they have done, therefore it's something they could do again. We can say that, the likelihood is very small if their situation is managed appropriately, and there are systems for that. I don't see it as a problem that can never be cured. The can never guarantee to the public that it will never happen again. The folks, the last part of your question about who responds best, the highest success rates have been found usually with incest offenders, with folks who offend within their own family.
That's really interesting. You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Susan Wilson, and with us today is Dr. Austin Delorier. He's a clinical and consulting psychologist with Larned State Hospital. We're talking about sex offenders and the programs that help them. What do you think? Does detaining sex offenders indefinitely make for a safer community? Is that the thing to do, to hold individuals for a crime that they may commit? Kansas City joined the conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. Or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Now, you were saying that incest perpetrators have the highest success rate. Is there a common characteristic among most sex offenders? Do they have a mental health issue, or have they experienced trauma themselves that they're trying to overcome? What's a typical profile, if there is such a thing?
Well, there isn't a typical profile. That's one of the challenges to treatment. I mean, there tend to be different kind of themes, I guess you could say. Some folks do come from very abusive backgrounds, and in some sense, you feel like maybe this person never really had much chance because of the family or caretaking background that they had. So that's one issue. Another is a type of person who maybe developed pretty normally till about adolescence, and that's usually a time when, as you know, Dr. Wilson, that peer relationships tend to develop and become strong, and for some reason these folks don't aren't as successful with that, and so then they tend to turn almost by default to younger people, to children who tend to look up to them, who tend to, you know, give them affection easily, to be directed easily, things like that. And so that's another strain. We also find a small group who, for whatever reason, seem to be neurologically wired to be aroused to children. It's a smaller subsection, but I actually feel a certain amount of sympathy for them because, in effect, if a person, for example, were a heterosexual, it's as if we were telling them, well, that's wrong. You have to be attracted otherwise, and that's just the situation. And we're telling them that what their body tells them is wrong in our society, and they have to behave differently. So so there's different treatment challenges posed by each of those.
Well, I think, and you know this, that from a public safety standpoint, it would be hard for most people in society to have sympathy, even if they are neurologically wired, for someone who preys on children. And I think you mentioned that before. But let me ask you this. You know, of course, there was a recent article in the Kansas City Star that talked about the fact that sex offenders are more likely to die in one of these treatment programs or in jail than to be reintroduced into society. Why do you think, if these programs are successful, are the discharges so few?
Well, first of all, the success rates that have been published have largely been based on outpatient treatment programs. There isn't a ton of research on programs like ours, of which there are about 19 other. There's about 20 across the country. There hasn't been a lot of research done on programs like ours, partly because, as you pointed out, the rate of completion of the programs is pretty low, so there's not a lot of people that you can look at.
me stop you there and ask, when you say completion of the program, you mean that the sex offenders who are in the program don't get through the necessary steps of the program, or aren't deemed at the time that they finish the program to be safe?
It takes a long time to complete the program. Typically, 7 to 10 years has been averages that surveyors have found when they've looked at our program. And so it typically takes a while. It's not, and then at the end, it's not always that the person is deemed to be unsafe, but it may be quite difficult to place them, to find a suitable location for that person to be. If I could mention the fact you brought up about that folks are more likely to die than to successfully complete the program, can I speak to that for a second?
Oh, sure.
The main, it is true. The main issues there are that typically our folks are coming to us from prison where they've served usually pretty lengthy terms. So typically a person is coming to us, late 40s, early 50s. We do have some younger folks, but our the average age of a person in the program is close to 50. And so at that point, we're starting to get the problems of aging and so a fair number of our folks get extensive medical care while they're with us, and some have led pretty hard lives in the past, and so they have pretty significant problems, and so they may not their bodies just may give out on them. That's part of the issue. And the other is, of course, that it's intended to be a lengthy, kind of a screening process and we have a very high burden.
Why does the program take 7 to 10 years? Does it take that long to really alleviate the kind of symptoms and urges that a sex offender might have? Is that why it takes so long?
Well, it doesn't absolutely have to, and some folks have gotten through in shorter periods, like in fact less than 3 years in some cases, but that is very unusual. The program is quite demanding and challenging, and there are also big elements of resistance in our patients that typically have to be overcome, because they often come to the program seeing themselves as victims of the system, in that, they served their time and now they're sent to a place, our program, where there is no time. I mean, where it's not based on time, it's based on behavior change. And so often it takes a person a fair bit of time to decide that they actually want to work in the program. And then finally, personal change, and particularly something that's a deep-seated part of a person, is probably the most difficult kind of work to do. So it takes folks a while.
Well, we're going to take a call right now from Claire in Sabana, Missouri. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. Claire, you had
Hi.
A question.
Yes, I had a question. Let's say a young man who is, say, 18, considered a sex offender if he has relations with his girlfriend who might be 17 or even 16. And the other thing is, if he is considered that, I feel like the times have changed a lot, and we may be putting a lot of young men in jail who really may not truly be what I would consider a sex offender. And that's my question and comment. I'll listen off the air.
And we have heard of those cases, Dr. DeLaurier, where just the situation that she brings up, where an 18-year-old maybe has sex with a girlfriend who's 16, father gets angry, presses charges, now he's a sex offender. Do those kind of cases end up in your program, or they take a different route?
Well, yeah, the short answer is they seldom wind up in our program. In fact, to my knowledge, no one with that particular kind of offense issue has come to our program. It is a fact that once our society, I think, became aware that we had kind of overlooked in many ways the problem of sex offending out there, some of the rebound effect from that was to cast a wide net. I mean, to where lots of different situations can be labeled under the law, and I think our caller Claire has identified one that can come up, and sometimes that has significant consequences for a person in that they have to register for as a sex offender for a long period of time, and you know, in my view, it's kind of unfortunate. It's sort of the fallout from the vehemence with which people began to attack the problem eventually.
So that, you know, she may be right, our caller Claire, that this may be an area of legislation worth looking at again in the future.
It could be. There might be ways to refine the law more, so it's not quite as wide a net.
Now, I do have a question. You say part of the reason that these people are held in confinement for so long is that first they're in jail and then they're in the treatment program. Has anyone looked at combining jail plus treatment, especially when it's understood that probably these guys and women who sexually offend, that's probably what they need after all. Why haven't we combined jail plus treatment?
Well, I think that's a fair question, and it certainly occurred to me also, Dr. Wilson, as a therapist, I would probably rather be treating them on the front end of the process with kind of the big stick of imprisonment over their head than in this process. We get them after they've been imprisoned, and usually... Well, and as we know, incarceration is a good way to make an angry person. And then on top of that, they're being sent to our program, so they're usually not happy campers at that point. I think what you suggest would be a viable approach. It's it would take some people really sitting down and you know, looking at how we could structure that. And I don't know if there's a, you know, a big will to do that, but that's what it would take.
Now, do you think that the sex offender registry is part of the overall harm reduction strategy when dealing with sex offenders? Because it certainly was part of the law. Do you think it deters people from offending again?
That's a good question. I do think it's part of the harm reduction process in that, you know, for example, we've had offenders in the program with hundreds of victims. I remember one guy who has now passed away who said every worked at a parking lot, and every day over his lunch hour, he would go through that area, which was a downtown kind of low income area, and find a victim, and find some child and victimize them, and that, you know, that went on for over a year. So, in that, and by keeping folks like that off the streets, I do think we're reducing harm. Whether we're deterring people by fear of going to our place, I kind of doubt that. Because you know, first of all, typically many offenders, and it's not just sex offenders, but don't know how much deterrent effect it has in that way.
What advice do you give, let's say, to a family member or a friend who thinks that their family member may have a sexual perpetration problem? Often that's a difficult situation because the family member or friend doesn't want to get the person in trouble. But at the same time, you know, it's not good to have someone like that potentially harm people. What advice do you give?
Well, it is a difficult situation because our presence system isn't really set up to first offer help. It's really set up to get people in the criminal justice system, and then maybe sometime in there they will get help. Because if, as you know, if a person comes in for treatment and they discuss harm behavior towards somebody else, sexual or otherwise, we have an obligation to report that, and it will then be investigated, and the outcome may be legal action against the person.
Well, thank you very much. That ends our segment on sex offender programs. We'd like to thank our guest, Dr. Austin DeLaurier, who's a clinical and counseling psychologist with Larned State Hospital. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking about women who are crime novelists with a group called Sisters in Crime. Central Standard returns in just a moment.